Good evening, members of the House. I declare this the 24th ordinary meeting of the 175th session duly constituted and call upon the Secretary to read the minutes from the last meeting.
On the 18th of April 2024, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for what was the 23rd ordinary meeting of the 175th session to debate the motion this House would elect the House of Lords. Very exciting. After the minutes are read, the meeting began with announcements. President Taft announced that our guest speaker was Lord Weir Ballyhome. Dermot would go pretty angry at me if I didn't give him his full title. Dermot Hamill announced where the post-debate pints would occur, in addition to announcing that £130 had been raised at the inter-varsity debate prior to this. Following a reading of the minutes, the meeting moved on to private members' business, regretfully. Ryan Hoey, HLM, raised the government's legislation to prevent those born after the year 2009 from buying cigarettes. Ryan himself was very perturbed and annoyed by this, hoping that it wouldn't be extended to Northern Ireland. Responses were heard from Dermot Hamill, HLM, HLM, Sam Hazlett, Tom Burns, and Ryan Hoey, and Dermot Hamill again. Max Kearney raised another scandal within the Parliamentary Conservative Party. It's been so many we can barely remember what that one was. Responses were heard from Ryan Hoey, HLM, Ella Griffiths and Zach Savage. Hugh Charles raised the Trump hush fund money. Thankfully, nobody responded. President's questions then took place. Jacqueline Bonner asked the President, accused the President of having a rather shabby tie. The President apologised to the House. Max Kearney then asked the President how he was. The President remarked that he was fine, despite having visited Bangor for the first time. Ryan Hoey, HLM, asked the President what he had for breakfast. After calls of shame ended, the President replied that he had nothing for breakfast. Zach Savage asked the President what he would make a carpet out of. This was relevant to something that had been said earlier in the night, but I'm not going to give any context to it. And diamonds was apparently the response. Don't have any idea what that's about. Dermot Hamill, HLM, complimented the President's tie. The President returned the compliment to Dermot, who is currently not wearing a tie. Max Kearney then asked the President what his favourite board game is. The former Conservative Party member, our President, responded with the game of Monopoly. After the President's questions, the vote in prior opinion was then held. There were 6 votes for aye, 12 votes for nay, and 3 abstentions, so the opposition had it. Lord Weir then gave some opening remarks about how he was at Queen's when there was thankfully no literific in operation, and that he owes his career in the Northern Ireland Assembly to it, so depending on what your politics are, maybe that was a good thing or a bad thing. Lord Weir remarked that he had a vested interest in not being made redundant and thus personally opposed the motion that night, remarking that the Lords, unlike other legislators, is robust and humorous in nature, and he praised the society on its recent successes. Trustee Martin Craigs then walked in. First of the proposition was Hugh Charles. He argued that the UK has been a democracy for 1,000 years. Okay? Meaning the Lords is an anomaly. It is a large and unrepresentative body overall, he argued. The coalition government proposed reform around a decade ago against this archaic model, but it didn't follow through. He then discussed the appointment methods of the Lords, which has no real scrutiny process according to him, and no qualifications as well. Selections by party leaders is also the case, pointing to the case of the Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron. Corruption is also present as well, with no accountability existing. And then we have the second largest legislative body in the world after China, yet the Lords has also a significant financial cost, costing around £140 million with no accountability or, quote, comeuppance, end quote. He argued that we should follow a similar model to other countries, but didn't specify which ones. First in the opposition was Ryan Hoey, HLM. He began by criticising the prior comments on accountability. He argued that the focus should be shifted from a surface-level debate towards the function of the House of Lords. Any reform must prioritise the importance of the Lords, not replicate the Commons in nature. Its constitutional functions must be acknowledged as a check as a deliberative body, and that we must further acknowledge the constitutional history of the Lords. The proposition, Ryan argued, is focusing on a panacea. He argued that we must discuss its role in detail. Reform would lead to partisanship in the House of Lords, and the Lords plays 2 crucial roles of scrutiny and revision of legislation. And it lacks a veto, sadly. The lack of a democratic mandate enables it to avoid challenging the Lords. Second on the proposition was Tom Burns. He began by shouting numbers. The proposition, this is a proportion of seats in the lower chamber to an upper chamber in various legislatures, the UK being all one out. He argued that the lack of accountability, this is going to be a recurring theme throughout the minutes here, particularly focusing on the appointment system. He argued that many peers are former MPs or politicians who have served well, such as Lord Weir in North Down in Strangford, looking towards our guest speaker at the time. The House of Lords is a rather weak body and it has no real ability to constrain the government owing to its own weaknesses. Here is the issue of parliamentary ping-pong. That's been resolved now, Tom, so your point didn't really stand. Annie argued that it's bigger, quote, it's not always better, end quote. Max Kieran then asked a question at this point. Or are you Max?
Yeah,
that explains a lot. Anyways, the Appointments Pro Commission is not wholly responsible for this problem. Second in the opposition was Pastor Jack Steele. He decried the modernism of the proposition's arguments, which are trying to destroy Britain's constitution. Our history goes back to the 14th century, not a thousand years apparently, and has been safeguarded by 1660 and 1689. We'll never guess which political party he supports. It must not be elected as it plays a great role in the constitutional system. He noted the constraints of various acts of Parliament and that it still remains constrained. He decried the 1990 Act as a form of decline, and he said that he was sad that he couldn't depose it at the time considering that he was not born yet. What is to be gained from a democratic system, he argued? The Lords can aid in passing reforms such as emancipation and the abolition of slavery, two issues that haven't been relevant for 200 years, and peers are responsible to no one but themselves. Peers are not carved by popular opinion and are free from the constraints of democracy. Our policy must be checked by the Lords, and they do a great job at that. Third in the proposition was Keira Swale, HLM, still wearing her coat. She began by doing rebuttals and focusing on numbers and elitism. People are appointed to the Lords, she argued. Fascinating point that, without any real representation. An elected House of Lords would lead to deadlock. She argued that an important point to note was that they can't veto legislation. Again, real groundbreaking research here, Keira. And she argued that an important point was, additionally, that the same powers would be in place under an elected body. She proposed a model not too dissimilar to the existing one, discussing the question of democracy and the growing distrust from the British public towards it. Many people are complaining about being London-centric, and it doesn't bring in too many perspectives, and she argues this can be rectified with an elective chamber. Third in the opposition was Max Kieran, who decided to sort of reenact sort of the sinking of sort of the Graf Spee and scuttled aside for his own side of the debate. He mocked the proposition and proposed a model near to the end of the debate. He critiqued the arguments of how turning it into an elected chamber would result in a better system. And he raised the issue of parliamentary supremacy, noting that we would have a crisis when trying to figure out who was the primary chamber. It was the Lords who blocked dangerous policies in the past and will do so again. And he noted the proposition will propose models which don't work in their system. And then Max proposed a model that won't work. Most governments are unwilling to commit to forcing through legislation all the time. And he raised the issue of mandatory attendance, something that will never happen. To deal with cronyism, we must deal with its undemocratic means. Our final speaker for the proposition was Dermot Hamill, HLM, HLM. He began with rebuttals. On Jack Steele's point, on the greater figures in the Lords, he mocked this and mocked Jack himself. He then argued that Dermot, as a, quote, ardent Brexiteer, and I'll say that a bit louder for the camera, Dermot Hamill, ardent Brexiteer, and wanted to ensure that dodgy civil servants in Brussels should not have power over our, quote, dodgy civil servants at home, end quote. He gave an anecdote of an offer of a peerage for cash. Maybe you were offered a peerage for cash, we'll never know. He argued he was standing for taking back control. He said this several times throughout the debate. The Lords appear when they're needed to and act on their own whims. Mandatory attendance is raised and he mocked that. He just mocked everyone, a horrible man he is. Horrible man-child, perhaps. And he noted that £1 million is paid to 60 peers who have never spoken in the Lords. He argued that we need to put powers in the hands of the people. The final speaker for the opposition was Grant Warren, HLM. He began by accusing the proposition of speaking nonsense and wanting a land of, quote, milk and honey, end quote. He mocked the suggestion that, quote, a thousand years of democracy, quote, is a thing. He argued that a few bad peers doesn't spoil the constitutional pie and counted the Commons is an elective dictatorship. He argued that the Lord stands as a barrier against legislative tyranny. Boy, we're using really big words here tonight. He argued that elected representatives are constrained by constituency work and that's another issue for members of the House of Lords. And to get rid of this would lead to a loss of experience. He raised the issue of the French Senate, which enables great powers to the President if they're aligned. He then raised the issue of a written constitution. He said it's nonsense. And he raised the ancient constitution, and I burrowed my head in my hands at this point. And then he asked for us all to turn the clock back to 1999 before Blair could, quote, destroy Britain, end quote. He listed scandals and then committed perhaps the ultimate Freudian slip, where instead of saying cash for peerages, Grant, a member of the DUP, said, quote, cash for ash. The questions were heard from Evie Beattie twice and Martin Craigs. While in the debate and questions of the House, the vote on speakerability occurred. There were 4 votes for the proposition, 16 votes for the opposition, and 5 abstentions, so the opposition had it. Some concluding remarks were given by Lord Weir of Ballyhoo. He began by congratulating all the speakers and admitted he had a more open view on the issue prior to becoming a member of the House of Lords. He argued that the Lords is the best supporting actor of British politics and democracy, and he commended the legislative and debate process in the House of Lords. He argued that the legislation benefits from expertise, and that is not really the case in the House of Commons. Peers largely aren't there hoping for higher office, unless your name isn't David Cameron. And an elected chamber has the risk of becoming an echo chamber. And then he compared restricting powers to the House of Lords to being, quote, getting castrated, stating that he would like to ask the male members if they would like this to happen to them. Nobody raised their hand, not even Oran. Regionalism could help, but it led to overrepresentation. An elected model would leave this being a stepping stone to higher and better office. Reform, however, may be necessary. May I take the minutes as read?
Aye. Thank you for that, Mr. Secretary. Welcome to the 24th ordinary meeting of the 175th session for the motion This House Believes the Presumption of Innocence Fails Victims, which is in collaboration this evening with the Law Society. Can I place on record my thanks to begin with for their help in getting this event set up and being delivered tonight? Before we continue any further, I would like to point out and remind everyone in the room that a number of sensitive topics will be raised this evening. As such, the usual rule in which you are not able to leave the room mid-speech has been waived. If you need to leave the room or are affected by anything that has been said in this room this evening, please do feel free to leave, and we'll be putting up some information at the end of the debate on the slide. Before I welcome the President of the Law Society to take over the chairing of this meeting, can I remind all speakers as well that they must adhere to the literific standing orders which have been provided to all speakers through the speaker group chats beforehand. Given the motion, I would also like to make clear that no speaker may mention, directly or indirectly, anything that could prejudice an ongoing criminal investigation or trial. Should you choose to do so, you will be asked to stop your speech. Without further ado, can I welcome the President of the Law Society to make some opening remarks.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, members of the House, it truly is an honour to stand before you tonight as President of the Law Society. Many thanks for inviting us to co-host this evening. Last week I said I wasn't going to wear the gown, but when in Rome. When I first joined Queen's, I genuinely thought Literific was a book club, and thought this until the end of first year. I could never in a million years imagine standing here as a guest chair. Of course, the initial title of this motion was, "If the glove does not fit, you must acquit." Obviously, given the recent death of O.J. Simpson, it probably is appropriate that we have strayed away from this particular motion. Last week was actually the first debate that I have attended in my 3 years at Queen's, and I would like to commend the speakers for their impassioned arguments on the House of Lords, although Mr. Warren saying cash for ash was a particular highlight. Our two societies share a long, rich history that has ultimately stood the test of time. In more recent times, in 2018, the Literific, supported by the Law Society, hosted the 58th grand final of the Irish Times debate, at which the training officer of the 170th session spoke as an individual finalist. Mooting and debating are intrinsically linked. Over the years, the old Debating and Mooting Society, which was formed after the Literifics collapse in 1967, grew more interested in mooting, and it was then that Paul Francis Shannon reformed Literific as president of the 163rd session, and according to your website, he is affectionately known as the Eternal Leader. This is a very busy time for most final year students, but being involved and leading a society takes this strain to the next level. Tomorrow is our annual Law Society Ball and the stress of the table plan. I'm losing my hair day by day. So I would just like to commend President Toft and the wider committee for their leadership of Literific as it maintains its stellar position within the university community. Thank you. Before we get into the order of business, we will move to council announcements. Does anyone have any council announcements?
So, for those that aren't aware, I'm the social officer of everyone's liver are terrific. I will first of all apologise for the fact that I got like a twinkie version of a 1970s official IRA. I did not realise it was debating until about 6:30, so I didn't bring a suit for me to Belfast, so that's my first apology. I'm not telling you where I got the jacket. But what I will say is, we're all going to Lavery's after, for some pints and for non-alcoholic drinks and for spirits and for whatever is your drink of choice. If I want to buy me a drink at any given point, I can get us whiskey or anything. Please do join us, and we'll all be going to Lavery's after.
The CITES annual general meeting is held next Wednesday, the 1st of May, in this room at 7 o'clock. Nominations for all positions are closed and manifestos have been published on the CITES Facebook group, which you can join through the link in the Instagram bio. Additionally, there are a number of amendments to the CITES constitution that I'm sure you'll be bored ridiculously with. But if you if you're interested in any of that, as is Mr. Hoey, please do have a look at that. And come along here to vote and question the next society committee, as I will be. And then next week on Thursday is a debate. This House supports the Legacy and Reconciliation Act. It'll be the final debate of the 175th session. The debate will be guest chaired by a man who tried to get rid of alliteraphic when he was a student at Queen's in 1967. He did not succeed, but he'll be coming back to guest chair the debate, Rory McShane, and the debate will also feature a number of reasonably high profile guests on both sides, as well as a number of student speakers. So do come along to that as well. The exact room will be confirmed early next week, but keep an eye out for that as the final debate of the session.
Cheers, Tom. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, my clothes.
Do you want to say their names for the minutes?
So now we'll move on to private members' business. This is the section of the debate where you can raise and discuss anything that you've seen in the news this week or something you're interested in and wish to put before the House. Do we have any pieces of private members' business?
So, for anyone who hasn't been watching the news today, the Scottish government's about to collapse. Hunter Yusuf, in his clear genius, decided that he was going to kick the Greens out of his government. The Tories then decided that they were going to call a vote of no confidence in him, and then the Greens decided that they weren't going to support his government that he just kicked them out of. So, as we can all see, great political moves from the leader of the SNP today. But I wanted to ask the House, what do they think of political brilliance from Mr. Hughes?
It's interesting because it does still hang in the balance. So now this is where me as a nerd of parliamentary procedure, Speaker of the Constitution Council. Interestingly, all it will take for the Scottish government to survive is if one member of the opposition votes with the government, which will result in a vote of 64-64, at which point it will fall upon the presiding officer to cast the same vote, which is going to be amazing if it happens. And there is one opposition member who could potentially vote with the government, and that is Ash Regan, aka the person who came third in the SNP leadership election on CSF, and he has since jumped ship to Alex Salmond's ALBA party, which means that she is currently the most powerful politician in the Scottish Parliament, which is an interesting time to just keep our eyes on and see what happens.
Anything on Scotland? Anything else?
It's a
shithole. Any other pieces of private members' business?
They all see four speakers and they're like, let's just get away. During a law debate.
Anything, no?
No, we'll move on.
So now we'll move on to President's questions. It's my honour to answer any questions you have. So do we have any President's questions? Obviously.
Mr. President, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Shame. I don't believe in breakfast, so I had nothing.
That's not for shame.
Mr. President, will you condemn the French?
No comment. Go ahead.
What do you mean, don't believe in breakfast? Elaborate, please.
I usually get up too late for breakfast, so it's already passed. So
does that mean you don't believe in the concept of breakfast, that you don't believe in existence? Like, have you ever seen breakfast? Can you confirm or deny whether or not you have seen or had breakfast in the past?
I can neither confirm nor deny, and my press office told me to say that as well.
Mr. President, is not the first meal of the day which you eat arguably a breakfast?
Is this all going to be a breakfast?
Well, yeah, you're hoping this can work.
Well, not for me, but anybody who wishes to have breakfast, I'm more than happy to support it. Go ahead.
Mr. President, have you ever tried to steal out a coffee for breakfast?
I have actually, in fairness, so yeah. That's a favourite on holiday. It's amazing.
Mr. President. Is your francophilia and objection to breakfast linked?
That's a good question. But I've never actually thought about that, you know. It could well be. I'll have to think about that a bit more. But,
Mr. Yes, Chair, Mr. Society President, with your leave, may I bring in some overflow chairs for the fine gentlemen standing?
No. Honestly, there are chairs there. Like, sit down.
Quiet,
go ahead.
Mr. President, what is your favourite book?
Oh, that's a good question. Very good question. Don't read a lot. One of those law tactics. No, I've actually read, The Modern Law of Evidence. It's thrilling. I actually read Michael Mansfield's book, Memoirs of a Radical Lawyer. It's pretty good. Read that holiday. Very good. Anything else?
Is official law soft policy to oppose breakfast?
To oppose breakfast? It is not, yes. Anything else? Go ahead.
Mr. President, do lawyers have souls?
Yes.
Hey!
Mr. President, do we need that
one? Yeah. Anything else? Because I'm a lot more than I expected, to be honest, considering I know about three of them. Nothing else? So, and finally, before we get to the debate, we'll move to the vote on prior opinion. This is a vote on how you feel about the motion. The motion is that this...
That is written wrongly.
Is it?
Sorry, read from top of the page for that one.
Oh, no, it's not. I changed it on the document. So the motion is that this House believes that the presumption of innocence fails victims. So we now move the vote in prior opinion, which allows you to state your view on the motion before you have heard any speakers tonight. If you would like to vote in favour of the motion, please raise your hand now.
What do we actually think?
If you would like to vote against the motion, please raise your hand now.
Our booth fuck.
If you would like to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand now.
Yes!
Silent majority. Bad setup. Can we have the vote on prior opinion, please, Mr.
So, on the question of hand, there were 9 votes for aye, 13 votes for nay, and 16 abstentions. So, by sort of north down margin here, the people who sit on the fence actually won the
Now, before we welcome the first speaker, I'm just going to run through the rules for the evening. A full list of rules through the standing orders is available on the website, but just for now, each speech is 7 minutes long, with the first and last minute being protected time. The end of the first minute of protected time and the start of the final minute of the speech will be signalled by the bell, which means you can only POI people in the middle 5 minutes. To POI, raise your hand and say a point of information on that point or simply POI. Please keep your POIs to 10 seconds and no barking, meaning wait at least 15 seconds after giving a POI to give another one. Once you've made your POI, you cannot go back and forth to the speaker. Lastly, no swearing. If a speaker swears, they will be fined. A bottle of port be presented at the next ordinary meeting. So I would now like to welcome the first speaker for the proposition, Matthew McCallion. Mm-hmm.
Starting now?
Good. Well, it's finally happened. After 9.5 years of literific membership, I've finally been roped into doing one of these debates. So, it gives me a great honour to open tonight's important debate by saying, my lords, Mr. McCallion, appearing for the proposition. And I beg to move that this house believes that the presumption of innocence fails victims. So, there is one thing that we need to clarify before we begin. And it's something I believe that I think both sides can agree on. And that is this: the presumption of innocence is a fundamental human right. Perhaps the foundational principle of the right to a fair trial. And it is indeed the greatest protection for individual liberty against state tyranny. But, despite its high regard, and its initial necessity, it is not perfect. There are times when it does fail victims and complainants. And I will say that my esteemed colleague Evie Court has a lot of very interesting statistics to back up that claim. So I look forward to hearing from her. But we must remember that justice is not merely about giving the defence a free pass. Rather, the right to a fair trial is a right which belongs not only to the defendant, but also to the prosecution and the victim complainant. To this end, the law has recognised over the years that the presumption of innocence can lead to unjust outcomes and may not guarantee the prosecution and the victim complainant their right to a fair trial. Now, one of these times, I'm only 2 minutes in, dear God. I encourage the opposition to feel free to intervene if they wish. But anyway, to that end, the court could bear with me 1 second. Thank you, I'm back in the room. There is another fundamental right, and that's related to the presumption of innocence, and that is the right to silence. Now, previously the law was very strict whenever it came to the strong protection of the defendant's right to silence, their right not to self-incriminate themselves. So it's the right not to say anything, the right not to have that right to silence questioned at all. But there are some instances where the law has recognised that the failure to protect that right to silence and to presume that the defendant must be innocent based on that right to silence can lead, as I say, to unjust results. So one of these times is whenever they're being questioned in the police interview, and they're asked the question about a particular point, and they decide to invoke their right to silence, they decide to give no comment and will not say anything. I ain't saying nothing. But man, whenever it comes to trial and they decide to take the, I would dare say, brave decision to testify in their own defense, not a good idea, let me tell you. And then they decide to provide an explanation for the event that they were questioned about. So to give an example take for example the case where a defendant is charged with possession of drugs with intent to supply. They were seen in a nightclub. This is a hypothetical case, by the way. They're seen in a nightclub and they are holding a bottle of drugs and then drop it and kick it away. And they're asked about that in a police interview and they say no comment. But then at the trial, they decide to say, oh, I just found them on the floor, I picked them up and then I saw what they were and I kicked them away. Previously, the prosecution could not question that. The prosecution could not say to the jury, you cannot look any further into that. You must respect that right to silence. And but now, in 1994, the law was changed to allow for what is called an adverse inference. In these circumstances, if the defendant decides to provide an explanation, as I say, for what was for something that they said no comment to when questioned on it by the police, the prosecution can now, in certain circumstances, provided not certain conditions are met, say to the jury, here, that fella's telling you a few porkies, isn't he? Yeah, he's telling you a lie. I mean, look at it.
On that point?
Yes, on that point.
Oh, you
can
have it because it was just before.
Yeah.
Who is the victim in a drug possession case that is being failed?
Well, it's very simple. In a drugs conviction case, where the victim would be the people who may be the potential buyers. Remember, intent possession with intent to supply. They're in a nightclub. They have a whole bunch of pills. They're not going to have them all on their own, are they? So, yeah. See. Mm-hmm. There you go. But anyway. To explain, in 1994, the law was changed. It's the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, 1994, Section 44, if you want to look up. Boom. But now, the prosecution can now say to the jury, why did they wait until the trial before providing an explanation for what they claim? I will conclude. For what they claim was a simple explanation. And that is a prime example of where the presumption of innocence, because it was seen to produce an unjust result that would fail potential victims, in this case, I see the looks from the opposition. I will wrap up. Yes. would result in an unjust result, and therefore the law did something to rectify it and show that you cannot take a pure interpretation of the presumption of innocence. And with that, I commend the motion to the floor. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. First for the opposition is Tia Arcara.
Hey. Hi, guys. I just want to preface this by saying I'm not a debater. I've never claimed to be a debater, so don't hold it against me. So I first wanted to address some of the points that were brought up by the first speaker of the proposition. The assumption that the defendant is given a free pass in a trial, the entire trial process is to decide whether to convict the defendant. The presumption of innocence is helping to protect the defendant from that. I mean, the process of the trial is essentially not giving them a free pass. On the points of right to silence, there are a lot of legal consequences to non-compliance, so I don't think that that really stands as a relevant point. And obviously, like, defendants aren't going to have perfect information. They're going to, like, make decisions based on how they feel. And when they're being questioned by the police, a lot of the time, someone who's been accused of a crime is going to withhold from saying things because they don't want to incriminate themselves. And if they aren't guilty, they should be allowed to speak up in the courtroom. And if they are guilty, when they speak up in the courtroom, they're going to incriminate themselves anyways. So the latter half, yeah? Oh, no, actually I'm okay, thank you. So the Latin maxim, ei incumbet probatio qui dicit non qui negat, which means that the burden of proof is on he who declares, not he who denies, ensures the due process that's required for a fair trial. Tonight's motion is that the presumption of innocence fails victims. The opposition holds that it rather protects defendants. The presumption of innocence was designed to safeguard those who have been accused of having committed a crime from having an unjust trial. It was designed for the accused. It wasn't designed for the victim, and therefore it cannot have failed them. No, thank you. The presumption, the principle is essential in a democratic society. We need the presumption of innocence in order to hold the state accountable and to protect the individual from its overwhelming power. Without it, defendants would be subjected to the atrocities that were experienced in medieval Europe, where women were accused of being witches simply for having greater than average strength. I mean, if that were the case today, I would be accused of being a witch because I am really strong. And that's just not fair.
Yes?
John Chitty,
hey, Magnus.
I'm really strong in my heart. That's what matters. Those who had been accused were dropped into water, and it was presumed that if they floated, they were guilty, meaning that it was impossible to be proven innocent, and they were all hanged. And I honestly think it's crazy for someone to be able to point at you and say, you're a witch, and then for you to be sentenced to death from that. Ironically, the Salem witch trials were stopped when the governor's wife was accused of being a witch. I guess the presumption of guilt is only valid when it applies to people that you don't know. Obviously, his wife couldn't have been a witch because she's not like other girls.
On that point,
Without it, defendants would be subjected to the atrocities that were experienced in Taliban Afghanistan, Soviet Russia, or Nazi Germany, where people flagrantly accused people they didn't like of treason or of being a Jew. I don't think I need to explain what became of those people. Imagine a society where you could point at someone, say that they've committed a crime against you, and they were automatically presumed guilty. Me personally, I'm a very spiteful person. I'm always preying on my enemies' downfalls. And I'm just a girl. Imagine this power in the hands of someone much, much worse. A man. But Tia.
On that point.
Yeah.
Sexism question mark?
You know what? Sexism is valid. These are all outdated examples. Okay, let's look at a modern day example. Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia maintains the presumption of guilt. The accused is often not informed of the crime, denied access to a lawyer, subjected to abuse and torture in order to get a confession out of them, unable to present a legal defense, and punished by physical harm. Saudi Arabia is also one of No, thank you. Saudi Arabia is also one of many countries in which being homosexual is illegal and punishable by death. Unless any of you are masochists, I assure you this is not the kind of society that you want to live in. In the UK, homosexuality was only legalized in 1967, and in Northern Ireland, it was only legalized in 1982. That isn't a very long time ago, and there's still a lot that needs to be improved. I'm not even going to get started on immigration. A judge's role is to interpret the law. That is why we don't have a codified constitution. That is why the burden is on the prosecution to prove that the law has been broken. And that's why we need the presumption of innocence. The proposition is going to try to tell you that the alternative is to be neutral. The alternative is the presumption of guilt. It is impossible to be neutral. We are inherently biased beings. It's in our human nature. Potty and I have been on the committee for the past year together, and one thing that you may not know about him is that he murders people. Now, I implore you to be completely natural about this information, to not make any judgments based on what I've just said. It's impossible. You're either going to presume that he's innocent, or you're going to presume that he's guilty, because it's in our human nature. Luckily for you, this is a principle that exists within our legal sphere and does not apply to our daily lives. In our daily lives, we use our own judgment, rationale, and logic to come to conclusions. We view things subjectively based on what we already know about people. In a jury, this bias doesn't exist because they don't previously know the people involved in the trial, and that's why you have jury selection. However, there is...
Bring your remarks to close, Dave.
Okay, however, there is a lot of non-personal biases that exist in juries through stereotypes, and the most stark example is people of color. The black people in America make up 13% of the population. However, 40% of the prison population is black.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Do you want to get the title slide up, if that's okay? Oh, just grab my... Am I okay to move the desk to the side so you can see the slides? Well, I did it anyway, so... Okay, so the argument that I'm arguing is the presumption of innocence actually fails victims, specifically of sexual violence. I just want to give a clear trigger warning. There are mentions of sexual violence. If you feel the need to excuse yourself, please, you're welcome to do so. The assumption of innocence does not safeguard survivors, and this is most likely been detailed by the previous argument about how the legal system and the judge is there to protect the presumption of innocence, is there to protect the defendant, the person accused of the crime. But I don't really agree with that, because the fact is the judicial system is there to serve justice by the victim, not by the defendant. Who protects the victim in a system that only ever protects the defendant? For example, we are told about this horrible time in medieval times where women were randomly accused of being witches and killed. Well, something that still happens from the medieval times is sexual violence. It happened before and it has sadly happened after. My argument is that the presumption of innocence is being used as a front to victim blame survivors of sexual violence. I will be calling them survivors from now on if you can deal with that. And the current length of sexual violence cases is too long to not be implementing safeguards, and therefore this presumption of innocence is being warped into a victim-blaming mentality that is only further damaging victims. You might recognize this man. This is R. Kelly. The presumption of innocence did not protect his victims, survivors, from any form of harassment, and in fact spurred trolls to attack victims dismissing their accusations. He was investigated from 1991 to 2018. A formal investigation from Chicago Sun-Times started in the 2000s. Only in 2021 was he convicted for violations of Mann Act and Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, and in 2023, of course, convicted for the production of child pornography. There's no denying that he has been found, presumption of innocence regardless, guilty. However, the survivors of the trauma he inflicted were not at all left alone by trolls. Geronda Pace, one of his accusers who did come forward publicly, said that she was trolled for speaking out. People called her a liar, told her she had no proof, and said that she was speaking out for money and was doing so because her abuser was high profile and she was looking for the fame grab. However, and this was only further expedited by the fact that Kelly's legal team was using this victim-blaming defense, calling his accusers groupies, saying they sought out his attention and pined to be with him.
On that point.
Yes.
Is there not a difference between the legal presumption of innocence and individuals presuming a person is innocent?
I'm going to get to that.
Go for it.
So, according to sources close to the disgraced singer, he routinely, just to kind of come back to this question, he started coming back to these allegations after a Facebook group called Surviving Lies proceeded to expose all of his accusers as liars. That was their title. It was not necessarily what they did. What they did in retaliation for these accusers was post a video of one accuser engaging in sexual relations, which is a form of revenge porn, and also shared the text messages of another accuser. The actions were in violation of Facebook guidelines and they were taken down. But my point is that these attacks and this presumption of innocence did not protect any of these victims from harassment. The idea that we leave it to a court to decide does not introduce the necessary safeguards for victims and survivors of sexual violence. I'll come back to that. Next one, please. So I want to talk about the statistical likelihood of a report being false. So, according to End Violence Against Women International, only 2 to 8% is the range of reports found to be inaccurate. Now, this 8% is based on assuming that the charges that were pressed were withdrawn. So 61% of police investigations have been closed in the last quarter because a victim decided to withdraw. 20% withdrew after the defendant had been charged, and 21% of rape trials are postponed at the last minute. And this details how the system fails to prioritize victims. No, thank you. According to the best available data, it is statistically, a man is 230 times more likely to be raped than to be falsely accused of it. Under the presumption of innocence, we are letting a system fail to introduce necessary safeguards, allow people who are abusers to continue to walk free until they are inevitably charged. No, thank you. Sorry, that's not what I just said. I was getting confused. My point is, it's statistically unlikely that a sexual violence report is false. But instead, trolls online, the media, are using this argument of presumption of innocence to play it that the victim is in fact seeking fame or money or fortune, even though statistically that's unlikely. Next slide, please. I want to draw attention to the Queen's University Belfast policy on the presumption made when it comes to a code of conduct violation of particularly sexual violence. Queen's actually instigates a policy where you can prohibit and implement safeguards to prohibit between you and the person you are reporting against. This clearly demonstrates, both in the serious misconduct procedure and just the conduct regulations, that just because there is a presumption of innocence doesn't mean that victims need to be left without any form of safeguarding. And this current system in our judicial courts, no thank you, proceeds to actually just allow victims to be further victimized and further attacked by the system. Yeah, I think that's everything. Thanks.
George Farnham.
thanks everyone for having us here tonight. I'm looking forward to it. I haven't debated before, so hopefully it all goes well. I'm just going to touch on some of the points that the last speaker made, that the presumption of innocence does not protect victims from harassment and that survivors are trolled. I'd argue that that's not a problem for the presumption of innocence, and that instead special measures which are being proposed, such as anonymity for victims and the accusers and also the accused, would be more suited to protecting them from trolls rather than affecting the presumption of innocence. I'm just going to touch a little bit on the presumption of innocence, the past, why it's important nowadays, and why it's important. So we've seen in countries and systems in the past where there wasn't a strong presumption of innocence, Nazi Germany, the Iron Curtain, East Germany, etc. Modern day, we can see that it's not strong in dictatorships, China, North Korea as examples. We've seen where it's gone wrong, where people can be taken away by the secret police, by the Stasi, and there's no strong legal safeguards. I will concede that those states had further problems than just the presumption of innocence, but therefore I would argue that the presumption of innocence is a fundamental part of any functioning justice system. I'd urge the proposition to name one country that could be a liberal democracy or a good country, however you want to phrase it, that does not have the presumption of innocence.
On that point?
Yes.
So you made a point at the beginning that was essentially stating that there are things that one can do to curb a strict presumption of innocence in order to protect victims. If you listen to anybody who's spoken before you, you'll realise that that is precisely what we're arguing in favour of. And the strict interpretation of presumption.
Was. So, no, the presumption of innocence is a principle. That's not modifying it. By putting special measures in, that doesn't affect someone's presumption of innocence. It's protecting everyone.
On that point?
Yes?
That doesn't make sense.
How so? Special measures protects everyone. Having anonymity would protect a victim, accuser, the accused. I don't see how it doesn't. If you'd like to raise any points, I welcome them.
Question?
Yes? As I'll continue on, it's an established human right. It's within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's in European Union law. It's an established principle across the developed world, in the United States, and anywhere that values freedom and democracy. Lord Sunkey, who was Lord Chancellor, stated that throughout English criminal law, one golden thread is always to be seen, that it's the duty of the prosecution to prove the prisoner's guilt. That means there is a strong presumption towards innocence. When we expand this thinking into schools, universities, and workplaces, there is a presumption of innocence and a general idea that is baked into our general sense of fairness.
Question?
Yes?
Would you say the Queen's University guidelines that I showed were fundamentally including this kind of presumption of innocence?
Yes, because those are special measures, I would argue, as opposed to a punishment.
Would special measures?
It's a strong safeguard. This is a sacrosanct part of the justice system. If this can be touched, what else can be? I would concede there are problems with a presumption of innocence. We do have a generally good system, but it does occasionally fail victims. But I would argue that the presumption of innocence would be left with a system that is not a system that is flawed entirely, and that would fail everyone and make every citizen a victim. I'd like to conclude my remarks, if there's no more points.
Just one quick question.
Yes?
So you said that it does fail some victims. So surely you're agreeing with the statement and our argument that it does fail victims. Some victims are still victims.
Yeah, but I say if you were to change it, everyone would become a victim.
Thank
you. What's that, sorry? Well, I'll conclude my remarks.
Just going to move that back if that's all right. Thank you very much. Better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent person suffers. That is what forms the basis of the presumption of innocence. The 10-to-1 rule has long composed the foundation of our legal system, but it is overwhelmingly defendant-centric. What of the victims, I ask? Of each single guilty person that escapes, how many countless victims are left failed? Now multiply that by 10, can we really say that that is justice served? The presumption of innocence means that our modern legal system will always be inherently biased against sexual assault victims, as a legal system that values innocence before proven guilty must always inherently favour rapists over rape victims. As outlined earlier, this is because the system is designed to favour false negatives over false positives, but with sexual assault, this problem is amplified. The presumption of innocence fails victims of sexual assault specifically because, unlike most other crimes, sexual assault most often does not have any witnesses, and neither does it have much circumstantial evidence, commonly devolving into he said, she said, and thus ultimately hinging on belief that the victim is telling the truth. Because sexual assault lies with the issue of consent, proof relies almost entirely on believing someone's word over another person's. Quite rightly so, we desire a system that requires the proper burden of proof be met. But the unfortunate and undeniable downside of this is that in instances of sexual assault, the presumption of innocence will fail victims, as it means that any and all criminal proceedings that are initiated require the victim to swim upstream for the duration of the investigation. I would like to clarify that I am not arguing against the principle of the presumption of innocence, but rather outlining how you cannot claim that it does not fail victims in the process, regardless of whether you believe this to be necessary. The fact of the matter is that the legal system is, and must be, inherently biased against sexual assault victims, not as a result of a deliberate design or because anyone made it that way, but simply because of the nature of the burden of proof. The burden of proof takes a different and far more challenging form in cases of alleged sexual assault when compared to most crimes, given its inherent intimate nature and the fact that it almost exclusively takes place in the private sphere, where cold hard facts and witnesses simply aren't present. The presumption of innocence renders suspects of crime or defendants in criminal trials passive, as they do not need to do anything to prove their innocence, which is assumed as the default. Not only can the presumption of innocence be seen to fail victims, but it can also cause active harm. While it may be fundamental to due process, it can inadvertently result in secondary victimisation of individuals who have experienced crime, particularly in cases of sexual assault or domestic violence. With research in trauma psychology indicating... No, thank you. The victim... No, thank you. With research in trauma psychology indicating the victim subjected to disbelief or aggressive questioning, experiencing heightened psychological distress, exacerbating the trauma of the original incident. Empirical evidence also suggests that when victims perceive a lack of belief or empathy from authorities, they are less likely to report crimes, leading to significant underreporting. This phenomenon has been observed in various studies examining the reluctance of victims to engage with legal systems characterised by scepticism towards their claims. No, thank you. I have already drawn your attention to this principle's failing of sexual assault victims, but let's move on now to consider the threat of terrorist attacks. Speaking in the lower house of Parliament in 2004, the former Dutch Minister of Justice said that the iron rule of criminal law, better that 10 guilty persons are acquitted than that one innocent person ends up in prison, does not apply to terrorism. In addition to this, the German Minister of the Interior also said in an interview that the 10-to-1 rule does not apply to the threat of terrorism, as it would be untenable, he claimed, to say that we would rather allow 10 attacks to take place than restrain one person who might not want to carry out an attack.
On that one?
No, thank you. Similarly, Prime Minister Tony Blair, in his speech at the annual Labour Party conference in 2005, suggested similarly when he said, the whole of our system starts from the proposition that its duty is to protect the innocent from being wrongly convicted. Don't misunderstand me, that must be the duty of any criminal justice system. But surely our primary duty should be to allow law-abiding people to live in safety. It means a complete change of thinking. It doesn't mean abandoning human rights. It means deciding who's come first. In other words, he said that the right of terrorism suspects to be treated as innocent persons is considered less important than the protection of those who are at risk of becoming victims of terrorism. Better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent person suffers. That, as I've said, is the basis of the presumption of innocence. But where does the 10-to-1 to ratio come from? Why 10 guilty persons? Why that arbitrary number? Does it matter? What if each one of those 10 guilty persons that escaped, each had 10 victims left behind without closure, without justice? Would that change matters? What if it were 100 victims? What if it were 1,000? If you think this is unrealistic, I draw your attention to the case of Robert Anderson, a sports physician working at the University of Michigan who died in 2008 with no criminal record whatsoever after having been alleged to have raped over 1,050 men and women during routine medical exams over nearly a 40-year period. I rest my case and urge you to vote with the proposition.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary, members of the House, You have heard it from the proposition themselves. The presumption of innocence is absolutely essential to our justice system. I suggest to you that if it is essential, it would be wrong and perverse to consider it a failure. The proposition has suggested that if we eliminate it, we will catch more criminals. In that, they are right. We will also catch more of absolutely everyone else. But I'll tell you who will get imprisoned more than any other group. The poor, the insane, the foreign. Those who struggle to prove a home address, let alone their whereabouts or their innocence. It is the dispossessed and the less than privileged that the presumption of innocence is most designed to protect. And that is because without it, they would be subject to bias. Now, I believe in juries. I believe in people. I believe that they've listened very closely to the instructions that are given to them by a judge. I believe if you tell a jury, vote for the side that you believe, they will. But what makes a man believable? I suggest to you that sometimes it's the way that they dress. Why do you think I'm wearing a tie? Why do you think they have dressed up very lovely? I'm going to be honest, the opposition disagrees with me on this apparently a little bit, but in any case, I would suggest to you that it might be the way in which they sound, and that they sound clever, sensible. You need not be sane, smart, or rich to be innocent. I believe that people can overcome their biases, but you need to ask them to do it. And that's precisely what the presumption of innocence does. I want to take a moment to respond to some of the points from the proposition.
On that point,
Go for it.
Yeah, you mentioned about you don't need the rich to find innocent or like
to be innocent. Yes.
To be innocent. What about your man Franklin Reed or whatever you call him?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm not sure
Evie gave a very informative PowerPoint on sexual assault cases and sexual violent cases. These are serious, and they do happen often. But the justice system is big. There's a lot of moving parts. I suggest to you that this one is sacred. I would reform almost anything else first.
On that point?
Go for it.
But have you not just admitted to the House that the motion does fail the victims of those crimes?
The justice system fails victims, which is close, but a different thing. The justice system does fail victims. The justice system actually fails pretty much everyone who's involved in it. It does not restore to victims what they lost. It does not fully rehabilitate the criminals who go through it. And us lawyers are not paid enough. God, darn it. However, the presumption of innocence does a very, very good job. I would say it succeeds and excels in protecting the group that it was supposed to, and that is literally everyone else. It's all of us. It's you and I if we get called into a jury box, brought forward to be judged by 12 strangers we've never met, and all that they know about us to start is that we're being accused of a crime. It is designed to protect more than anyone else the dispossessed. It's an achievement of our society. For that reason, I would vote with the opposition. I would say that it has not failed, it has excelled. I would suggest to you that the proposition has given many of its beneficial key points, and that the things that they point out as failures of it are much more failures of the justice system in general. Thank you.
Thank you.
The name for the proposition is Dan McCormick.
Hey, Kellen.
All right. Right, listen, I'm afraid I didn't have time to write a speech. Apologies if this is ever so slightly ad hoc. Not quite. Now listen, as last speaker, my job is to recount what has been said. Last speaker, not counting Dermot, but look, the point is this, is that I'm to stand up here and give you an accounting of the gist of my side and what I make to be the gist of their side and tell you really a summation of what's going on. But really, I don't think I need to recount what these folks said. Sure, you all remember when Matthew got up at the beginning and he says, we should get rid of the presumption of innocence and institute a secret police. You all remember that. You all remember when he got up and said that. I thought it was a little late there, but look, that's what he said. And then you'll remember. Then, as we went on, not only did we argue in favor of the Salem witch trials, by God, we argued very, very heavily in favor of it. I could tell some of you weren't convinced, but look, I'm beginning to see the light of it.
On that point,
now, sure.
I thought you weren't going to recount your side of the
argument. Good one. Look, the point is this, folks, is that I'm sorry to do this to a group of people who, the majority of whom gave a disclaimer before they said anything about your experience debating. Look, at the end of the day, with this, you guys, as the opposition, you're funny enough, actually, George, you brought this up. You had said that in a criminal trial, as you all know, there's roles on the defence and on the prosecution. They have certain positions that they have to fulfil. And the thing is that the prosecution's job is like getting a plastic bag and they start filling it with water, okay? And the defence's job is to turn around and poke as many holes in that until the jury are convinced that that bag couldn't hold enough water to prosecute someone. Now, that's essentially, that's the sort of dynamic. And funny enough, you mentioned that in criminal trials, that's the dynamic we have going here, okay? The thing is, you've decided to poke holes in somebody else's bag of water. You've not poked a single hole, insofar as I'm concerned, in our argument. Our argument, indeed, has been that though the presumption of innocence, which is the first thing that was said, though the presumption of innocence is a fundamental cornerstone of our legal system, nobody's arguing with that. Nobody's arguing that remotely. I actually work in the courts, believe it or not. I had to say that somewhere. Come on, guys, give me a bit of credit. The bottom line is, though we agree with that, and we agree that that's the fundamental thing that keeps the system running, what we'll all agree as good people is that victims shouldn't be protected, both victims of, though unlikely, victims of, say, for example, false allegations, both victims of actual criminal activity in every facet. We agree that victims should be protected. So we do. But
on that point,
go ahead.
Can you really call the cornerstone of the justice system a failure?
No.
Absolutely essential.
Have you read the motion? I mean, think about it. Okay, so you're claiming that we're saying that the presumption of innocence, it's a failure. That's it. It's done. Let's consider it in the bin. Right? Let's install something else. Now, not only, I mean, I don't know where you get that from, because not only have we proposed something alternative, because we're not proposing to get rid of it. What we are proposing is that it fails victims. Something that you didn't say, but you said, and you said. Both of you said it. And this
point,
is the thing. Sure.
I said removing it would create more victims.
Would it? Sure, it would. Absolutely, it would.
So, would that not be a failure?
Absolutely, it would. But that doesn't affect remotely our argument. It just doesn't, folks, because that's not what we're arguing. What we're arguing is that it fails victims.
Point,
and it does. Sure.
How would you stop it from failing the victims then?
With the constraints. The constraints and the means that they implement, the special measures, there you go, that's the actual term they use, in order to, in some sense, circumvent a straight interpretation of the principle in order to protect the interests of victims. Now, without doing those things, with leaving those things out, and throwing everything out the window, you either create more victims if you get rid of the presumption of innocence, or you fail victims as the justice system in its current form, we believe, does. And I think that that's, in and of the face of it, it's clear. It is obvious. No, thank you. Look, I'm just going to wrap up here and say, at the bottom line, the presumption of innocence, it's a good thing. Victims, they ought to be protected. Ultimately, victims are not served in the way they are. They said it, we said it, but only one of us is actually on the right side of the debate. And so I think you should vote with them. I think you should vote with us, the proposition. Thank you very much, everybody.
Daniel,
God, he's good, isn't he?
Right. I will just point out that I joined this debate 6:30. That's when I agreed to this. So I didn't have time to write a speech. Not that I normally do. I didn't really know what the presumption of innocence already was. And I haven't been to a law class in quite a long time. And I also am enrolled in law at Ulster University, so you ought to kind of consider my law training a bit moot. I know that word, that's something. There were some points made, most of them kind of left me shaking a little. Kind of didn't want to touch most of them. But there are, the arguments, at times, sometimes the bag just didn't hold all the water. Because, as pointed out, someone else's bag. The second proposition speaker didn't really seem to talk about the presumption of innocence. And while, of course, we all recognise that the statistics are jarring or scary, they're absolutely awful, that, you know, we found that, of course, that they were harrowing. But really and truly, they weren't overly related to the presumption of innocence. They were just kind of a discussion about how the entire justice system fails victims of sexual assault and those involved in sexual assault cases and in sexual violence cases. And we don't disagree, the entirety of the justice system fails them.
Excuse me.
In a moment. I think the contention that those of us in the opposition are trying to offer, at least we were as of 6:30, is that it isn't the presumption of innocence that fails victims. It's the wider justice system. It's the courts that our dear lovely Daniel works in. It's that entire point. I think the really interesting point brought up about terrorism was, I think, the one that interested me most. Of course, the 10-to-1 rule, we shouldn't apply the 10-to-1 rule there. Of course, we understand the dangers of not applying the presumption of innocence. Those of us in here know that better than anywhere, because we had internment. If ever there was a time of presumption of innocence protecting victims, not in this case of terrorism, but of the wider legal system, it was in terms of internment. Internment was the greatest point of which we should have had the presumption of innocence, but instead we scrapped it and we said it didn't defend people. You know, this is that was the clear moment where it pointed out not only the importance of it, but it pointed out that really the presumption of, you know, of anything else was what failed victims. It failed those involved, it failed the victims of terrorism, it failed everyone else, it failed those that were believed to be perpetrators in a wee moment, my dear. I got this text during the debate from my dear friends on the opposition, so if it's wrong, blame them, because I've literally copied and pasted the message into my notes tab, which if it's been proven that a sexual act has actually occurred in the cases, excluding Northern Ireland, we're going to get that out there, excluding Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland is really backward. If it's been proven that a sexual act has happened, and has been proven to have happened with it beyond a reasonable doubt, really and truly, excluding what is the fairly fucked up kind of defence of the rough sex case in Northern Ireland, there are limited cases where the defendant can actually adduce that there was consent. It's very difficult to prove consent otherwise. Now, in Northern Ireland, that's where we're a little bit backwards. Thank you, DUP and Sinn Féin, for turning down the Assembly for a number of years. I have written down, if I talk about drugs, maybe edit it out. I think that was a message to Daniel whenever there was a point about drugs brought up, which didn't really seem to make sense. I mean, if the big legal crime you were going to bring up, Matthew, was drugs, drugs in a nightclub, which I suppose in a lot of cases most people would see as a victimless crime. I mean, if I go to my drug dealer, who I don't have, and I text him and I say, Mr. Drug Dealer, I would like to buy some drugs, maybe some cocaine or, you know, I don't know, whatever all the kids are sniffing these days. I wouldn't know. And I say, one moment, Matthew. If I say, Mr. Drug Dealer, you know, you sell me some drugs. I'm not the victim here, I'm the guy actively seeking out the drugs. Whatever these drugs may be, I wouldn't know.
On that point,
About drugs? Sure.
I mean, for one, the massive amount of people who have been spiked by fentanyl. And for another, I don't see the point that you're making. It's another Salem witch trial. It's another whatever it was you brought up. I've forgotten it now. But the same thing. It's all the same. You're not arguing with a single person on this side. Argue the point we've made.
Well, Daniel, I am doing exactly what you told all of us budding lawyers to do. I'm poking holes in the bag. And this is the bag your partner put forward. He talked about drugs, and I'm going to take his bag, which is not full of drugs. I'm going to take his bag, not of drugs, of water, in, as you pointed out, and I'm going to poke as many holes in that because I see it as the weakest point your side made. And by God, I'm going to deal with the weakest point because I had no prep for this. You see, and yes, of course, people are spiked, but most people aren't buying drugs to go spike people. I mean, if I text my imaginary drug dealer, who I don't have, and say, I would like to buy some cocaine, sir, and I'm going to go and I'm going to give you my money, and he's going to say, Dermot, there you go, there is some cocaine. And I don't know what it looks like, I think it's white. And I'm going to go to the bathroom and I'm going to get my little rolled up note and I'm going to go, but that doesn't make me a victim. And if then we put him up one moment, you can put your hands down because you want to get sore arms. You know, if he's then put up in the dock, yes, back to time. See, if he goes up there and he's on the dock and they go, what about the victims? We ought to presume he's innocent because he hasn't really failed any victims. The presumption of innocence, as pointed out, was not set out to protect victims. It was to protect defendants, those who may possibly be falsely accused. And therefore, it couldn't have failed victims because it didn't have a duty to them in the first place. It is the wider justice system. I mean, the point about harassment of victims doesn't really hold any water, because even if we presume to say R. Kelly was guilty, which many people did, or if we presume that Paddy Jackson was guilty, which most people did, and most people still do, his victims, or their victims, would have been harassed anyway. We can't clearly link that to the presumption of innocence. So I'm taking your bag not full of drugs, I'm taking my needle to it, and I'm trying to poke as many holes as possible, and I like to think that those of us on the opposition have done a fairly good job at that. So, in conclusion, don't buy drugs, that's bad. Don't commit crimes, because that's bad. And the presumption of innocence is a good thing. It doesn't really fail victims, because the duty of it isn't really to them, but is to defendants and those falsely accused. So, my friends, please, vote opposition, vote your conscience, vote your country, vote your God, vote opposition. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to... Quiet, please. Thank you very much to all speakers. By my count, this evening had 5 maiden speakers. So can we first get a round of applause? We'll now move to questions. How this will work is we'll do a question for the proposition, which the opposition will then be able to respond to. We'll then go to a question to the opposition, which the proposition can then respond to, and then we'll go to an abstention question, which must be put fairly to both sides. So firstly, do we have a question for the proposition? Kara.
Okay, so here's the issue with the way the Prof have argued this tonight.
Okay.
They've argued this as if it is what I've called all or nothing motion, which I don't think is very fair to the other side, because the way they're arguing this, that all they have to do is to prove that it failed at once, which is not fair to the other side. And it's the easiest argument that they could have made, and what argument they could have made and should have made was that it overall failed victims, because then there's a debate. If that side argued, all right, we only have to prove they failed them once, then where's the debate? You're just sitting there going, oh, it failed them once, you're done. Which isn't fair to the other side. You have to argue that overall it failed. Thank you very much.
Right. Proposition.
Look, we're not arguing that it just failed somebody once. That's not actually our argument. Our argument is that it does fail victims. It fails a great many people, we believe, and we've shown the statistics. of the volume of people and these cases in one specific area, but there's many more where cases fall apart as a result of the way, the lack of safeguards in favour. Now look, Dermot made a point, and I think it ties into this very, very closely, is that the presumption of innocence doesn't owe victims anything. And I think that anybody, upon a cursory examination of that notion, will recognise its utter horseshit. So it is now costing me about a point.
It's on two now.
It is utter horseshit. It owes, like every cornerstone of the legal system, it owes itself to justice. It owes itself to that higher thing. Not the defendant, not the victim, not anybody in specific, but all the stakeholders. That means everyone in this room and outside of it. Every single person is owed a debt by the legal system and every fundamental principle within it. It's not exclusively to one side, it's not exclusively to the other. And that's the point we're trying to make, ultimately.
Opposition response.
It's a very strange theoretical argument on the nature of cornerstones. Every single judicial principle has to be for every person. But what about the exchange of evidence? That's not for the defense, it's extremely bad for them, but it's still an important judicial principle. I mean, look, there's pretty obvious that you can have an idea of how a courtroom should be proceeded that's designed to balance it for one party, as long as there are other opposing forces that balance it for the other, so that's overall fair. Literally, the way we represent our legal systems is two scales weighing two separate things against each other. They have to even out, ultimately, but it's not a bunch of, you know, things that are connected on both sides. It's weighing opposing interests. I very much appreciate the question, because yes, technically all they had to do was prove that two people in the history of the judicial system had been failed by this particular thing in order to, in a sense, make their argument. I think that ultimately, it's a lot more interesting to ask, well, is it for victims, the presumption of innocence? And I think that you really have to come to the conclusion that that's not the interest that it's trying to balance. All of us, if we are to live in a functioning society and democracy, have to figure out how we're going to balance not just one offended party, but literally everyone's hooked in it, including criminals, honestly. So, appreciate the question. I would say that the point about principles is an odd one, very theoretical, very playful, you know, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Do you have a question for the opposition? Mr. Burns.
They didn't have to we got rid of the controversy that a woman would be a victim. I think it's kind of a fairly sort of like common law centric approach to this, which is sort of specifically very few countries. But there are nations across Europe and we're more concerned about this and have a very different legal system. There's a very, very different way of operating that kind of ensures that, or makes does its best to ensure pre-trial that no one's conversion goes before rather than didn't commit or shouldn't commit it. So there are other ways of getting around this that still protects victims, makes sure not everyone gets victimized without really abolishing the presumption of innocence. The whole kind of central tenet of the argument kind of falls on this, that there are other ways of getting around this that still protect victims.
Am I allowed to ask this one more?
On the question,
I have no idea.
Okay, so I live in France currently, so I'm going to use France as an example. I know a lot of people here don't like France. I'm just going to go ahead with it. If you look at the inquisitorial system in France, you can take, like, I'm pretty sure it was just last year the justice minister was accused of having used his position as a means to take out like personal agendas, and it's almost impossible to avoid. The magistrates' union in France literally went out and said that this was weakening the entire justice system in France, and it was weakening the entire inquisitorial system because it's so hard to stop the use of. Because in the, like, for those who don't know, in the inquisitorial system, the judges are essentially investigating the trial themselves, and so they're putting their own like two pence in. They're using their own biases, unlike in the adversarial system that we have here. And so it's very easy for a judge to only take on cases or only convict in cases where he thinks that when he has his own personal agenda.
Can you proposition to respond?
I'm really sorry, could you just clarify what the question is?
There are systems that are subject to work differently to ours, basically a different operating system in which, like as you said, sort of it's inquisitorial rather than adversarial. So there are ways in which the sort of system can work differently that still protects victims, but doesn't, I mean, not everyone in France is a victim. I think it's kind of a central point, and they have a very good system that doesn't use a bunch of evidence as a core principle of the legal system.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important and all of this, but and at no point did the proposition argue that for like a complete abolition of the presumption of innocence whatsoever. We merely show it that there are flaws in it, and you can't deny that it does fail victims regardless of whether or not you do think it's necessary. And I think it's a really important point that you've raised about the fact that there are a number of different legal systems that still have a presumption of innocence but that don't fail victims. So it's not a necessary core part of that principle.
Do we have an abstaining question? Go on, Max.
I would be interested to hear what both sides believe the effect would be on the burden of truth if we were to say, following up of Tom's question, in the fact that there are systems in place that don't necessarily have the presumption of innocence as a cornerstone, would the increased burden of evidence required by the sort of defence to prove that there is reasonable doubt, would that help victims or would that hurt them?
Proposition first.
Can you clarify the question for me if it wasn't listening?
What do you think the effect that it would have on the burden of evidence for victims if we did shift to, say, what Tom suggested, which is an inquisitorial model in which the sort of presumption of innocence isn't necessarily present? I know it's not technically a question, but it's an interesting theory.
Well,
can I take this one?
Sure.
Sorry, I just find it really interesting when you mentioned the burden of proof. So specifically for the issue of sexual violence, the burden of proof actually kind of does vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So for example, at the current domestic level, if you are a victim of sexual violence, the argument that was raised by, I'm sorry, I don't remember who said it, about consent and proving consent is necessary as part of this burden of proof. However, when you're looking at it at an international level, at the United Nations the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, this idea of proving consent was completely void given the conflict situation. Because if a man comes into your house with a gun, the consent that you would give is not exactly fully free of free will. So I think that this idea that the burden of proof shifts is definitely something that could be explored. I mean, it's something that I don't think would undermine the idea of the presumption of innocence, but what it does do, I think that we need to recognize, is the burden of proof. What kind of proof are you asking? And does it necessarily involve putting a victim in a situation where they're having to recount something that is horrific to them and is going to further victimize them within the system? I don't agree with the argument that's been put forward that the presumption of innocence doesn't play a role in failing victims. And I don't think the judicial system is designed to protect, not protect the victim. The victim is the purpose of the judicial system. And to say anything otherwise is just to completely nullify what the judicial system is.
Thank you. Opposition?
I think first of all, that references with at least in a way with British law students, so yeah, bear with me.
British and Irish law students.
British and Hans is an inquisitorial system, which is a really interesting one. And they have, you know, they've been a lot of that 99% conviction would be okay. And I think we can, you know, we can go back and forth on whether inquisitorial systems, whether adversarial systems are much better, you know, better or not. I think it's kind of very difficult to, I suppose they're almost impossible to compare, because if you look at our adversarial system, almost, you know, it's laid within, you know, very specific national boundaries. So if you look at Japan, they have a 99% conviction rate, and no matter how many crimes people are committing, how many of those are real convictions? You know, if you take away, you know, whether there's a presumption of innocence or not, 99%, I just don't think that really going to work. Saudi Arabia is an inquisitorial system, and Saudi Arabia, it's not exactly famous for law, justice, and you know, everyone's right to fair trial. I think why we can sit and talk about how wonderful the inquisitorial system is and how much it protects it, because it doesn't really, you know, and how the fuck do you write that down? The judicial system is, you know, I don't know. I think we can, you know, really and truly, the inquisitorial system, while perhaps it might work in France, it's not exactly this party of law and justice and, you know, all the wonderful things about the country. And really, I think you can't really compare the presumption of innocence in that when really we spent the entirety of talking about the British, Irish, American law. So I just don't, I think you can talk about it, but I just don't think it's really relevant to any of the cases we've brought up. And I just openly don't think it works.
Thank you. We'll now turn to the vote on speaker ability, which is a vote on which side you believe spoke the best and which you are most convinced by. For the motion, this House believes the presumption of innocence fails victims. If you'd like to vote for the proposition, please raise your hand now.
What the fuck are you three doing?
It's four bottles of pop.
This is our side, right?
Yeah.
Oh, is it? Oh!
Thank you. If you'd like to vote for the opposition, which is these people, please raise your hand now. And if you'd like to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand now. Can we get the vote on speaker ability, please?
There were 22 votes for the proposition, 9 for the opposition, and 9 people were not listening. So the proposition has it.
Thank you. Can I put on record my thanks and the thanks of the entire Terrific Council to the Law Society, who have co-hosted this evening with us, put forward half of the speakers, and helped us organise such a great debate. So can we get a round of applause for them, please? As far as the Terrific is concerned, we have our final debate of the session next week in... possibly here, possibly not here. So keep an eye out for exactly where that'll be. On the Legacy and Reconciliation Act, with a number of notable guests and a guest chair. We have our annual general meeting next week, on Wednesday evening in this room at 7 p.m. So please do come along to that and support whoever for whatever election, and there's various constitutional amendments and honorary life memberships to be given out. And now, just as a final note, I'm conscious that this evening has included a number of sensitive issues that, you know, perhaps maybe other debates don't. If you've been affected by anything raised this evening, the council would encourage you to seek advice and support, and some of the places you can do so are now listed behind me. Thank you very much. Can all the speakers come to the front for a photo? Thank you again. And we're all going to lab. Thank you.